Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and the tragedy in Gaza continues. The genocide in Gaza continues. The truce, which lasted for 7 days, where there was a brief pause in the bombing, in the destruction of hospitals, the destruction of schools, water treatment facilities, of vital infrastructure, civilian infrastructure in Gaza City and the entire Gaza region. There was a pause for 7 days. That ended on Friday. And Israel is once more bombing the Gaza Strip, and hundreds of more civilians, Palestinian civilians are dead. This is horrific. Just the amount of war crimes that just are piling up every day boggles the mind, scars the soul. It's very difficult to reckon with. And I tried to do that when I attended the protest, the demonstration, which took place on Saturday, December 2nd, Guelph City Hall. There were only 100 of us this time. I think the problem was, you know, unlike the thousands who showed up, or the many hundreds, or over 1,000 who showed up in October and November, the protest which took place then in front of City Hall. I think a lot of people thought that the truce, the 7-day truce, in which there was a prisoner exchange, many people thought that was it. I think they thought that was it, that things would go back to normal now, and they could turn away. That is not how it is. And there was a major disruption on the second, you know, where, you know, Palestinian activists in downtown Guelph, like, you unfurled a banner and disrupted the tree lighting ceremony that the mayor was leading. Because, of course, the mayor is like a diehard supporter of apartheid Israel. He said as much. That event was disrupted. You could tell a lot of people with their families were not pleased about that, but it needed to be done. It needed to be done. People needed to know that this genocide was going on. It's being carried on. It's being supported by the government of Canada, who's standing in rock solid support of Israeli apartheid. Same with the American government, the governments in Europe. All of them are standing by this apartheid regime, which is conducting genocide and, you know, giving them weapons, giving them diplomatic cover, you name it. And this is at a time when, like, the entirety of the rest of the world basically stands against Israeli apartheid. I mean, you just look at the votes that have taken place recently in the UN, in the UN General Assembly. Basically, every single country except the US and its allies are demanding a ceasefire, a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. You look, an end to this genocidal violence. And it's always the same small group of countries who block everything and give cover for these crimes to continue and the bloodshed to continue. I was one of the people who carried a banner at the demonstration on Saturday. A banner which had the names of all the people that we know of who have been killed in Gaza since October 8th. All that we know of, because there are many people who are missing, many thousands of people who are missing, but there are more than 14,000 names. I mean, I've seen the death toll be as high as 20,000 now. We're not 100% sure, but it is a gruesome figure. And I carried that banner. And, you know, we marched, we occupied an intersection for a time. We were able to cause a certain amount of disruption. You know, we once again trying to call attention to what is going on and what is being done. And the horror of it all, right? And it was difficult. I couldn't put my feelings into words, because our words fail us, you know, in times like this. They really do. They fail us in times like this, and prose fails us at a time like this. And we have to resort to things like photographs and poetry. And poetry. There were multiple poetry readings of Palestinian poets at the demonstration on Saturday. And it was very powerful to hear those words. But I was reminded of a poem which really spoke to me when I first heard it. It was by an American photojournalist, William Pepper, and based on the horror that he witnessed being perpetrated in the Vietnam War, and just the another situation of colonialism and colonial violence, and visited upon a whole people, on a whole nation in Vietnam, just as it is in Palestine today. And this poem is called The Children of Vietnam. And I think it's appropriate for me to read it right now, given the number of the thousands upon thousands of children who have died and are still dying in Gaza today. It goes like this. I come and stand at every door, but no one hears my silent plea. I stand and yet remain unseen, for I am dead. For I am dead. I am only 7, though I died in My Lai long ago. I'm 7 now as I was then. When children die, they do not grow. My hair was scorched by swirling flame. My eyes grew dim, my eyes grew blind. Death came and turned my bones to dust, and I was scattered by the wind. All that I ask is but for peace. You fight today, you fight today, so that the children of this world may live and grow and laugh and play. And the children of My Lai, this village, this Vietnamese village, were of course slaughtered, along with their mothers and their grandparents, in March 1968. In March 1968, they were massacred by American soldiers. And so we go from March 1968 in My Lai to Gaza in December 2023. And we see the carnage. We see the 7-day truce, to some extent, allowed us to see just how bad things were, uncovering some of just almost unspeakable crimes, which took place and were uncovered when. You know, there was a chance to actually kind of investigate what was going on. The bombs stopped falling temporarily. I want to play right now. This is going to be very difficult, but I think it is essential that we listen to it. This was broadcast by the Electronic Intifada. In their latest live stream, which took place on the last Thursday, the 30th of November. And so this was the day before the truce expired. This was the day before the truce expired. So they're not talking about the more recent bombings and airstrikes and whatnot. But they talk about one particular incident, at a particular hospital in Gaza, and that is what they discuss here. It's very important to listen, and I would hope everybody who listens to this show also listens to the Electronic Intifada podcast every week. It's I would say essential in a time like this, but. Please listen to what they have to say in this clip, and please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Derek, yesterday we published a story that I wrote about the just gruesome and horrifying discovery of 5 Palestinian newborns who on November 10th Up until November 10th, we're being cared for diligently and carefully by physicians in the neonatal intensive care unit at Al Nasser Hospital in Gaza City. And as Israeli forces did with many hospitals and medical centers across Gaza in the last few weeks, they stormed the hospital. They ordered physicians, patients, and family members, and also displaced people who were taking shelter in the hospital, to leave at gunpoint. And the physicians, you know, were not allowed to take these newborns that need intensive care with them. The Israeli army apparently told the physicians and the parents that the Red Cross would take care of them, but that failed to happen. And then on Tuesday, a journalist was let back into the hospital 17 days later and saw that the infants had been left alone to die alone with their intubation and intravenous lines still there attached to their tiny bodies. I mean, the footage here that you can see, obviously the babies are blurred out, but it's an unspeakable situation there. And I wrote about this, and we were just talking on the phone yesterday, you and I, about just the horror of this situation. And what's your reaction to what happened? What does it say about the sadistic nature of Israel and its accomplices that would let this happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really obvious here. You know, when we kind of look at such a terrible situation, we have to really take a moment and mourn the victims of October 7th and condemn Hamas for what they've done. You know, it's somewhat obscene to me that while these things are happening, we're constantly being sort of told that the Israeli army is doing something good here, that they're liberating people, that they're even honoring the memories of people who were killed. It's such an absolute travesty to see this happen. And for me, obviously, the thing that hurt me the most, having watched people die, I made a commitment to myself when I was pretty early on as a doctor, that I would never let somebody die on my watch alone, that I would always be there holding their hand. Because death, as somebody dies, it's there's almost always a kind of pain in their eyes, a kind of fear as they're going into something new, you know, the people who are aware of what's happening. And there's a comfort, maybe just for me, in holding the hand of somebody who's dying while they take their last breath, what we call the agonal breaths. And as those agonal breaths pass, you know, you sit there and you watch their body go from something that was living, something that could give life, into something that is dying, something that no longer can. These children weren't just robbed of their lives, they were robbed of any kind of dignified death. So were their families. Maybe these children would have died anyway. You know, some of them were probably sick. That's why they're in an intensive care. But they would have died with loving families. And I think that would have made all the difference in the world. But there was something else. There was another thought that hit me. You know, when you ask yourself the question, like, why? Why did this happen? Why? I'm not yet able personally to say that somebody took a decision to let those children die. I can't process that possibility, you know? And so I want to think that, like, maybe it was an oversight, maybe they forgot, maybe they didn't know, maybe a million things. But it's very clear to
Israel
me,
took a decision to let them die.
In a very indirect way, I guess, but like I understand what you're saying, Ali. I can't personally imagine. I don't want, it's not that, like, my brain cannot process the possibility that a human being looked at five young children and said, fuck those kids, we're going to leave and let them die. I just can't process that right now. And that may very well be exactly what happened. But if I can just sort of carry on the thought a little bit further, it struck me that had it not been for the work of all of these people, us and others, there would have been a death count of 39 higher. Because it's clear that the reason why this happened was because there wasn't enough international pressure on the Israelis, enough public relations pressure, etc. And it's also clear that had they had the same path, had they been able to abandon the 39 kids in Shifa, that most likely that would have happened too. Yeah, to me, it's a sobering reminder of our the mission that we have to make sure that we're protecting all of these patients while simultaneously, you know, having to bring some accountability into this situation. Anyway, sorry, Ali, I had cut you off a little bit.
No, not at all. I think the big picture, I can understand exactly what you're saying. I think the big picture, though, is that the assault on the hospitals was deliberate, that Israel took the hospitals as targets and set up to systematically destroy them using these different pretexts and lies, sometimes not even bothering to give an excuse or a pretext, but as John said, as part of their intent to systematically dismantle the infrastructure, that the civil infrastructure that makes Gaza livable. So that was the decision. And of course, this is a particularly horrifying that these babies were left to die alone on top of it. But there have been many, many other patients who died who couldn't be evacuated from the hospitals or who were unable to remain on life support or kidney dialysis. Several kidney dialysis patients died. One slight piece of good news, of course, good news is all relative, is that they did manage to partially reopen the dialysis unit in Al-Shifa Hospital in order to provide kidney dialysis to people who would have died without it. Tarek, I'm curious what you're hearing about the ability of doctors to do things like that, to restore at least some of these life-saving services, or just how difficult that is to do. One thing nobody needs to have known is that when I was a student, I had an administrative job in the nephrology section at the University of Chicago Hospital. So I spent a lot of time around kidney doctors and patients. And one thing I know is that dialysis requires a lot of supplies, a lot of consumables, as well as the electricity for the machine. So they had said that was only a partial and temporary opening, and it didn't sound like it was sustainable. It was just to provide a one-off dialysis for as many patients as they could. What do you know about that, or what do you think they can do in a situation like that?
Yeah, I'm not a nephrologist, so I haven't, I probably wouldn't even understand the full details of it. However, the broad strokes are pretty clear. Essentially, with dialysis, every time you get dialysis, it resets a counter. And the better the dialysis, the closer that counter resets to zero. And the closer it is to zero, the longer you have before you need dialysis again. At a baseline, Gaza's not able to provide adequate dialysis for all of the patients who are around, like at a baseline. the way that they use the machines, the what's called the flows, are inadequate. And that all has to do with the fact that they have to run these machines at 24 hours a day. And so in order to do that successfully, they have to run them at suboptimal sort of settings. Similarly, just like you said, the consumables is another thing. So imagine, for example, the consumable, like what would be a good way to describe it to a non-medical person? Think of the consumable like a tampon, okay? And so basically reusing consumables, which is happening right now, is like reusing tampons. And that is in the cleanliness of it, in sort of all of the different factors, especially, by the way, when you don't have a safe place to go to and clean water to clean it with. And so they're being sent home with the consumables, the various filters and so on, or left with them so that they hold on to them, and then told, okay, come back and bring your consumable because we don't have another one to give you, we don't think. So it's always been terrible. I mean, the dialysis patients were almost the first to die when the blockade started in 2006, 2007, 2005, that time period. And we know that this is not going to be great. But I think what they're doing now is they're trying to buy those patients a little bit of time, maybe time to a ceasefire, maybe time until they get to Egypt, maybe time for whatever. But they know if they don't do this, all of those patients will die.
Shoot the sick, the young, the lame. We do our best to kill and maim, because the kills all count the same. Napalm sticks to kids. Flying low across the trees, pilots doing what they please, dropping frags on refugees. Napalm sticks to kids. Flying low and looking mean, see that family by the stream. Drop some nape and hear them scream. Napalm sticks to kids. A group of gooks in the grass, but all the fighting's long since passed. Crispy youngsters in a mass. Napalm sticks to kids. Drop some napalm on the barn, it won't do much harm. Just burn off a leg or an arm. Napalm sticks to kids. Gather kids as you fly over town by tossing candy on the ground. Then grease them when they gather round. Napalm sticks to kids. Ox cart rolling down the road, peasants with a heavy load. They're all VC when the bombs explode. Napalm sticks to kids. Cobras flying in the sun, killing gooks is macho fun. It's one pregnant, it's two for one. Napalm sticks to kids. There's a gook down on her knees, launch some fluchettes into the breeze. Her arms are nailed to the trees. Napalm sticks to kids. Blues out on a road recon, see some children with their mom. What the hell, let's drop the bomb. Napalm sticks to kids. They're in good shape for the shape they're in. But God, I wonder how they can win with napalm running down their skin. Napalm sticks to kids. CIA with guns for hire, Montagnards around the fire. Napalm makes the fire higher. Napalm sticks to kids. A baby sucking on his mother's tit, children cowering in a pit. Dow Chemical doesn't give a shit. Napalm sticks to kids. Teen kids in a no-fire zone, books under arm as they go home. Last in line goes home alone. Napalm sticks to kids.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and what we just heard there was a protest song, a very hard-hitting protest song from the Vietnam War era called Napalm Sticks to Kids by the Covered Wagon Musicians. That's a song that doesn't pull any punches. It's a very hard-hitting, brutal, in-your-face, and captures the horror of war in a very unvarnished way. It shows how murderous it is. How murderous Vietnam was, and also how murderous Gaza is right now. How murderous the assault on Gaza is. How murderous its targeting of civilians, targeting of kids is. And you can bet that basically the Israeli soldiers who are dropping these bombs and who like launching these shells and, you know, invading Gaza in tanks, they basically have the same ethos as those American soldiers in Vietnam, you know, dropping napalm, you know, all over the place. And burning people alive, right? And not feeling any remorse, you know what I mean? This is the thing. That song, the Covered Wagon Musician song, was originally a song by an actual American military unit bragging about killing kids in Vietnam. And it was turned into a protest song by a group of dissident veterans who put it on an album called We Don't Want Your War. And the intention was, of course, to show just how horrific this was. You know, how horrific this was, how inhuman this was. The entire ethos of this war was, and just how it turned you into a monster who was willing to do these terrible things, like kill children, basically. But this is the reality on the ground. I don't think we should shy away from seeing that. We need to see it. We need to stare the horror of it all like full in the face. I think that's absolutely crucial. I mean, you might notice I didn't offer a trigger warning there. I don't exactly believe in those. I believe that the reality must be faced so we can come to grips with it, so we can fight it. No sugarcoating, no varnishing, no subtracting from it at all. I believe that is a disservice, and it belittles and to some degree dehumanizes those who have suffered. Now, I want to continue in this vein, basically talk about how the medical system in Gaza has been systematically targeted by Israel. For demolition. There's been multiple attacks on hospitals. People probably have heard about what happened in Al Shifa, where the whole hospital was stormed by Israeli forces a few weeks ago. Al Shifa was not the only one. There were attacks, bombings, you know, you name it, on like hospitals. There are hospitals in the West Bank as well as in Gaza have been stormed. And doctors have actually been arrested and effectively disappeared. You know, the director of Al-Shifa was recently arrested, and who knows where he is now. He was arrested by Israeli forces, taken away, along with many of his colleagues. I believe about 24 of his colleagues. They were taken away, and we still don't know their fate. And that actually is the Electronic Intifada, the same podcast, the podcast on November 30th, where they talked about what happened to those kids and those premature babies at Al Nasser Hospital. They also talked about what happened with the detention of these doctors at Al-Shifa. And they actually talked to a doctor who actually worked in Al-Shifa. He's actually in Canada right now, but he's a doctor who was there. He knows the condition. He knows these people who have been detained. And so I want to turn over to that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
We are going to bring in another friend of ours, Dr. Tarek Loubani. He is based in Canada, but he has years of experience working at primarily Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Tarek, thank you so much for returning to the EI live stream.
And thank you so much for having me. It's great to see you all. And Ali, wow, your talk at the beginning was amazing.
Thank you, Tarek. Good to see you.
Tarek, as a physician, what can you tell us about, where do we even start about the healthcare situation in Gaza, especially just with the basic fundamentals of not having clean water, you know, for over 2 million people, you know, including people who are in dire need of medical attention?
Yeah, I want to talk about that, Nora. But before that, I want to mention, just so that it's top of mind and so that it's something that I say, that many of my colleagues are under arrest, very likely being tortured and with the Israelis trying to get false confessions from them. When I was 22, I was arrested by the Israelis. I was a 22-year-old know-nothing who was of no importance at all. And I got the interrogation treatment. I got the torture. And so I can imagine what they're experiencing right now, because the Israelis are so interested in generating whatever story they want to come up with. So I think as we talk about the medical system, we talk about the different pillars. Of course, water is an important one, but so are the people. And the people who make up the system, who have been betrayed by the world over in general, and more specifically by what the ICRC did by abandoning them to the Israelis in that exact moment. I think we should just sort of take a moment and urge all of the viewers and listeners here to find out more about the people who were kidnapped, who were arrested, and to insist through whatever channels are available that they're released safely and in a timely way.
And some of these physicians are close colleagues of yours, including Mohammed Abu Salmiya, the head of Al-Shifa Hospital. Can you talk about what happened to him? And I believe he was kidnapped and arrested with four other of his colleagues, including the head of a hospital in Khan Yunis. What do we know about what happened?
Yeah, at this point, I believe there are 13 people who have been arrested so far. The two doctors, I guess three doctors who I know the best, one of them is Abu Salmiya, one of them is Dr. Munir Shafiq, and then the other one was one of our residents. And obviously, you know, these are doctors who knew what they were getting into, in a sense, because it's been a long time since they've had to interact with Israelis who were willing to arrest them inside Gaza. I don't think any of them really expected, especially under the flag of the ICRC, for them to be subject to that kind of arrest. I mean, Dr. Abu Salmiya really is a classic example of how the Israeli system works. It took him in with no charges. For no reason. It's keeping him with a very specific purpose, even if it finds him somehow to be not guilty. If it ever decides to charge him, he will have lost months of his life, you know, at the very least weeks, but probably months of his life. And all we can hope is that the maw of the Israeli prison system doesn't catch these other doctors too much. But I was thinking about this. I was talking to one of my colleagues and thinking the same way in which all of us who have children sort of think, like, I would take any injury that my child would have. You know, for one of my residents, one of the people who I teach, who I've taught, who I've sort of like nursed in terms of his medical education, for him to be arrested, it is such a deep pain. Obviously, I'm not trying to center myself in that, but, you know, it's one of the things where I think all of us who teach him feel an obligation and feel our failure deeply. And of course, the thing that is most, makes me most bitter about that is that I feel my failure deeply. And yet the ICRC does not. I see their statements. They definitely don't feel their failure deeply. And I don't see why.
Tarek, just to stay with Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya, for example, and he's only one of a number of healthcare workers who have been abducted by Israel in recent days. Dr. Abu Salmiya is the director of the Al-Shifa Hospital, which you know very well, and which Israel invaded and destroyed. And they are alleging that he is, and obviously they didn't find anything, not even the Western media was persuaded by the Israel's claims to have found tunnels or whatever it was, certainly nothing that lived up to the hype that Israel had been trailing of this James Bond-like command center under Al-Shifa. And clearly there's no such thing, because by now we would have seen it. But they are still claiming that he was somehow involved in what Israel calls terror. Of course, people will know that Israel considers like looking at them wrong to be terror. They have already defined major human rights organizations such as Al-Haq and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights and Ad-Damir and so on as terrorist organizations. But what I want to say about Dr. Abu Salmiya, and this is important, about what he may face now, I think that we have to think of the case of Mohammed Al-Halabi, who was the Gaza director of World Vision. World Vision is a major international Christian-based charity. It's a, you know, it serves everyone, but that's where its roots are. That was funded by many governments, including the Australian government, its work in Gaza. And Israel abducted Mohammed Al-Halabi about 7 years ago and charged him with trumped-up charges of diverting millions of dollars of World Vision's budget to Hamas. Now, this was laughable at the time because World Vision, including its main office in the United States and its Australian division, said it's impossible because our whole budget in Gaza didn't amount to a fraction of what Israel claims was diverted. How could he have diverted $50 million, which is what Israel said, when the whole budget over a period of years was something like $2 million? But nonetheless, and the Australian government and World Vision did their own audits and their own investigations and said, there's no basis. This is Australia under a right-wing government, which is no friend of the Palestinians. And even they said there's no basis for these Israeli charges. And but they put Mohammed Al-Halabi through 6 years of detention through this show trial that went on for years and years and years, and finally found him guilty with a secret verdict where they only published snippets of the verdict. And even the State Department and the British government and others, you know, true enemies of the Palestinian people, said this is a show trial and this is nonsense. They didn't buy it. But Mohammed Al-Halabi is in prison. He was sentenced to 12 years. I raise this case because this, I think, is the real danger that Dr. Abu Salmiya and the other medical workers and humanitarian workers face of these show trials by this regime that has abducted them, and why I think it's so important that we keep Dr. Abu Salmiya and the other medical workers front and center, and that people who are watching this live stream and who may watch it afterwards are also, in addition to continuing to contact their representatives about an immediate ceasefire, an immediate end to the siege, immediate accountability for the war criminals, that all these health workers be freed, and that no credence be given to Israel's usual lies about them that are used to keep them in prison.
It's stunning how thoroughly consistent this is with my experiences in the other sort of country dictatorship of Egypt, where I was accused of things including carrying 300 kilograms of weaponry and walking around with it. Like, I mean, I've been working out. I don't think I could carry 300 kilograms of weaponry and just chill around the squares of Egypt. And yet these things are presented. Oh, and the other one was Tachabur ma' Hamas, okay? But also Tachabur ma' Mossad. You know, and these charges are presented credibly by these systems, because the systems don't care what the charges are. The systems only care with what the sentence is going to be, or what the story that they want to float is. And in this case, it's incredibly clear. I remember when I was first in jail, I used to say, you know what, let them try me and let's work it out. But the system is corrupt even in that sense. There is no trial that can happen in Israel that would result in a decision that is fair and just for these men. And so really what has to happen is enough political pressure to force the Israelis to release them. And I'm really hopeful that that happens. I guess the other possibility is that they could be considered as prisoners within the exchange deals. But I hope it doesn't even need to come to that, because it's such a travesty that they've been taken. So thank you for letting me talk about it, and thank you for amplifying that.
Yeah, of course. To kind of recenter focus on what physicians are having to deal with right now, even as, you know, the bombs have stopped falling for now. But what is the state of the healthcare system in Gaza right now, as far as you know, as you've been talking to your colleagues there?
So there's a mix. Obviously, it's terrible. Everything is terrible in this context. Like, I don't think we can say anything other than that. However, holy crap, are they doing amazing things. For example, they've clearly, I know that this happened as well in 2014, where there were committees that were struck that were making life and death decisions, you know, out of a philosophy ethics textbook about, you know, do we turn this off? Do we turn that off? How long do we let somebody live before we give that resource to somebody else? And here what they've decided to do is they've decided to turn on the things that help people without really follow-up. So what do I mean by that? You've noticed that they've started reactivating dialysis centers. Why? Why are they reactivating dialysis centers? Like, how does that make sense? Well, dialysis is interesting because you are going to die if you don't have it. You come in, you have it, and you go home, and there's no real follow-up other than the fact you need dialysis again. If they had instead reactivated the operating room for orthopedic surgeries, well, what does that look like? So essentially, you get a broken bone that needs a surgery. Those are serious breaks. And then that seriously broken bone has to be healed, which requires consumables, drugs, sutures, gauze materials, cleaning things, so on. But then after that, you're not done. You need to keep that person in hospital for a period of a few days, maybe a few weeks. And then after that, you're still not done. You have to change the wounds, pack them. They might get infected, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So they've really made a decision that I didn't even really know was on the table to support the maximum number of people with the minimum number of resources that are available to them. The other piece of it as well is that should the hospitals get bombed again, which is unfortunately a real possibility, these people aren't captive in the hospital. Whereas when they do surgeries, they might turn people who could otherwise have been discharged into people who can't be discharged. So it's been like, I think it's literally like the worst exam question in an ethical bioethics class. What do you do in these scenarios? And they've navigated it so admirably, so courageously. It's been really, really incredible. The system itself kind of depends on three big things. It depends on human resources, it depends on materials and disposables, and it depends on infrastructure and infrastructural support. And right now, all three of those things are missing. None of those three things is available, somewhat maybe a little bit in the south, definitely not in the north. And I think that's the problem we have to contend with.
The monsters came just the other day, thought it was a dream. Rain, fire, causing pain, heard the children scream. Eagles thundered from the midnight sky, death beneath their wings. Found their prey in sleepy streams. Gift from Star Wars King. Met the devil in the dusty lane, close by crossroads town. Saw the gleam in his fiery eyes, as flames danced all around. No freedom without guns. Break the chains, rise up, please, put the devil on the run. Freedom's day has come. Silhouettes in a Belfast night, dark figures stalk the streets, bringing pain or plastic bullets out to every kid that he meets. Strangers' laws and strangers' ways can never hold us down. Risen hearts with freedom's cry, resistance is all around. Death now.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Bic. That was B-I-K. A song called Monsters, Devils, and Strangers. That song was recorded by Irish Republican prisoners of war in a British jail in Northern Ireland at the, I believe it was the early 90s. When the struggle... The resistance struggle in Northern Ireland was still going, really going full tilt against British colonialism. And there was a lot of solidarity between them and the people fighting against apartheid in South Africa and the people fighting against apartheid in Palestine as well. They all understood that this was one struggle. and they stood in solidarity against apartheid in all its forms, and colonialism in all its forms, and empire in all its forms. This is what, whether they were Irish or South African or Palestinian, you know, this is one unit. And that's why I wanted to play that. I know this has been a hard listen for many who have stuck with me this far. This has been a very difficult time, but we need to continue listening. We need to continue standing with Palestine. We need to continue to show up, go out in the streets, demonstrate, spread the word, have people understand what's going on, and don't look away. Above all else, do not look away from what is going on, and maintain the solidarity in any way you can, because we have to bring the pressure to bear. The pressure on politicians is starting to work. They're starting to move away. Some politicians in Canada and the States, including the president and the prime minister, they're starting to move away from full-throated support for Israel and at least starting to talk about, I mean, they're completely inadequate responses, talking for humanitarian. They still won't call for ceasefires, basically. It's up to us. We have to pressure them, put the pressure on, keep the pressure on, make them understand that there's going to be a price to pay, to be paid, you know, if they continue giving full support to apartheid. They're going to pay a political price for that. And they're going to lose their careers, you know, they're going to their names are going to be mud. We have to keep the pressure on. We have to keep, ultimately we have to keep fighting for change. We cannot stop. We cannot turn away. We can't, there is no going back to normal. You know, we have to keep fighting. The Palestinians are continuing to resist. They will always continue to resist. We have to stand with them. So with that, I want to thank you for listening to today's program. Solidarity, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends. I'm going to see you next time. Peace. And ceasefire now.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me, the Bill of Rights froze me, in jails they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and leap on me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body, their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police they arrest me, materialists test me, pollution it chokes me, movies they joke me, politicians exploit me, city life that jades me, Hudson Bay fleets me, hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling, revolutions rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate.